Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome you and our Shaw TV audience back to our SACPA question period. And a little housekeeping to undertake before we get to the questions. Our speaker next week is Debbie Middleton Hope. She retired from the Calgary Police Service and moved to Lethbridge recently, where she has evaluated community services related to domestic and sexual violence. Her talk is titled Domestic Violence, Evaluating Our Community's Response. Kind of reminds me of Law and Order Special Victims Unit. I also remind you that SACPA has a website. It provides audio recordings of talks and the question and answer sessions. You can listen to the recording at any time on your computer. And in addition, you could submit written comments. So that, you know, SACPA has long provided a unique public service, and the website acts as a kind of a window to the world. Our topic today was making the most of Alberta's tar sands. Our speaker is Cosmos Voutsinos. The question period is now open. Please try to keep your comments brief and limit yourselves to one question. And we are stuck with this situation after playing Russian roulette with the microphones that we have only one left. And so we'll have to arrange for speakers to, or questioners to climb this little mountain to pose them. Yeah. Yes, you'll have to come up here and, right, please state your name. I forgot that point.
Yep.
Paul Hillman, MLA for Carson Tabor Warner, but thank you very much for being here. And it's always great to have someone who is thinking of our best interest. And I'd have 50 questions, but you talked about the hydrogen that it would need to replace the natural gas to process the bitumen. I'd like a little bit on that, but also, do we now have the technology to build reactors that burn the waste, or are we just in the process of having that? And I know it takes a long time to build it, but do we have the technology now?
The first part of the question is for the hydrogen. In the tar sands, the coal beds that are up there, one time they were oil. And slowly the gas has evaporated. That's the gas, natural gas that comes out, it evaporates. And it depletes the hydrogen content of the oil and makes it a bitumen. If you want to make it oil again, you have to add hydrogen to it to make it oil in order to go out to the markets. That's what the cost about. And it needs 1,000 cubic feet per barrel of gas. The second part of the question is, nuclear power, it's an evolving technology. It is not a complete technology like there are other technologies mature like the oil fire stations. Right now, the plants built are the old design, or the thermal types, as they call, and some fast breeders, that they still produce some waste. Now, some of them, they don't produce as much waste as others, but there is, on the drawing board, the concepts and the detailed technology is known how to go by to do it. In addition, there is technology known how to spike the plutonium and make it, while it will be suitable for nuclear plants, you can give it to anybody who could never make a bomb with that, because it would be spiked. So it's an evolving technology.
Just for the fun of it, I'm married to a lady of Greek, I'm Ralph Rall, married to a lady of Greek ethnicity. Just so you'll know, if you want to refer to this gentleman, to your neighbor, you call him Cosmos. If you want to talk directly to him, you call him Cosmo. Only the Greeks could come up with that kind of stuff, but anyway. One of the concerns I've had, I had two on nuclear. Cosmos has already addressed in terms of minimizing radioactive waste by burning it, using it as a fuel. But the other had to do with, I guess, what you might call nuclear accidents. And Cosmo, I think the group would find it very interesting for you to talk about what's gone on at Chernobyl.
Okay, that's a loaded question. Okay, here we go. You have, actually, in the nuclear industry, we have had two accidents, the Three Mile Island and the Chernobyl. Both reactors suffer exactly identical problem. One reactor had hardly any consequences to the public, except frustration and fear. That was the Three Mile Island. The Chernobyl had lots of damage. 30 people died instantly. Another 4,000, I believe, are dying from cancer, most of them children. Why the difference? Well, the one plant was a much more modern plant than the other. The Chernobyl was the plant that we have discontinued in North America since the 50s, I believe. They have been discontinued. They have they're unstable. They have some graphite core. That graphite is charcoal that will burn if there is a heat. So, and what happened in Chernobyl, it was exactly what happened in the Three Mile Island, except that the roof was not made to withstand the pressure of the chemical explosion that took place there and open up and dump out all kinds of radiation into the environment. There is, and it was a lot of radiation, more radiation than was emitted in the Hiroshima type, but there's a difference. The force of it was not as much, much less. You didn't have a nuclear explosion, you had a chemical explosion like a dynamite. Now, 20 years later, there were some people that they went and they took readings in Chernobyl. And that's an interesting thing. I mentioned in the paper, that's what Ralph is referring to, because it would be of interest to people. They took measurements. There is a 5-mile radius around the plant that they call it the no man's zone, and then there was further down. And there are people, they live in the town of Pripyat, that it is between 2 and 4 miles inside the 5-mile non-man's zone. They live there for 18 years. They have chickens, they get their, they have the plants, they grow the crops. They take the blood test very regularly, and they are very healthy. They are about 400 people. Around the 5-mile radius, there are plenty of life, wildlife, wolves, horses, plenty of things. Crops are growing. And people, where they say that it will kill hundreds of thousands of people, only killed about 3,030 instantly. So what you have the amplification of the news goes out of control sometimes by trying to make more than what it has been there. Yes, it was the worst industrial accident, no question. But the consequences, they were bad when it did happen, but after that now, it is not really so bad. I had an atlas, and I opened it to read the atlas, this, my new atlas, and where the page was writing about the human history, I realized it did not say anything about the end of the American Revolution or the Second World War, but it was saying Chernobyl in 76 exploded, devastated Europe and spread, devastated all Ukraine and so forth, thousands of miles of land, and devastated Europe with radiation. There was nothing like that. There was, but how much? When you get an explosion of a nuclear plant, and let's say the roof collapses, out they go, and then they will settle down. All the radiation, all the radioactive particles are heavy metals. Heavy metals don't float in air and go a big distance. They will go 2, 3 miles, 5 miles, and the readings that the people they talk from, the Texas A&M, I think they did the readings, prove that that was the case. So Yeah, it was bad. It shouldn't have happened. It had nothing to do with the technology. It was the way they handled it. They were totally, totally careless, the people they were handling that plant. In fact, they didn't even have boron on the side to turn off the reactor because boron is shutting down the nuclear fire in a plant. They didn't even have that until 10 days later. They didn't inform people of the danger of the iodine, that it will float. And children were playing in puddles of radioactive water. So, but is that the technology the problem? We had two identical accidents, yet two different consequences to the public, basically. I hope that answers your question.
Just talk briefly about iodine, possible.
Okay. When I mentioned that when the reactor opens and the radioactive particles come out, most of the heavy particles, they settle within the 5-mile radius, where they call no man's zone. Now, that's true. There are only three elements that they will travel any distance. It's the iodine, the cesium, and strontium. So what you have, the iodine is, now, outside the skin, they will not really bother you in the quantities that you may be exposed to it, but internally, if you ingest it, it can be very bad. So iodine dissolves in water, and it has a tendency to go around the thyroid, to concentrate around the thyroid, and thyroid is actually 1,000 times more sensitive than any other part of our body to radiation. I don't think dentists have realized that. But anyways, so what they do, as soon as you have a nuclear accident, an accident of that kind, or any kind of form of release radiation, you're supposed to give the people iodine pills. And they go around the thyroid, and they put a coat around the thyroid, the non-radioactive iodine. So when the radioactive iodine comes, it stays away from the thyroid. It doesn't cause the damage. So, but the authorities there, they did not, and then after a week, the iodine is, the danger is gone. The problem is they did not give the people pills, iodine pills, until a week after, which was meaningless. The cesium and the strontium, they're coming down as a dust. So I wouldn't mind having an apple if I can wash it properly. That would be fine, and that's, people can cultivate crops there. I wouldn't have any strawberries because it's difficult to wash and get out of the pores, this type of thing. And I wouldn't have any meat from downwind animals or milk because they will graze on the grass and then they will take it inside and get it and ingest it. So cesium and strontium are about 4 years before they're safe afterwards. So for 4 years you have to find where the wind was blowing and import from the upwind area products like dairy products and strawberries, if you like.
Cosmos, my name is Gordon Campbell. Cosmos, I'm so glad you came today. It's a pleasure to hear you, your gentle, quiet, and clear logic arriving at conclusions, which you do. My question is based on the assumptions behind all of your arguments. Because, gentle friend, your assumptions are just about opposite to mine. I'm not sure that you are speaking as much as I would like you to speak about the collective good of these resources, which are owned by the people of Canada, and it is the function of the government to regulate these collective resources to the benefit and well-being of the people of Canada, and not to the corporate interests of agencies that exist throughout all of the world that work within the system which you work within, the capitalist system. I would like to see some other magic word other than profit as the fundamental driving force for the treatment and benefit, the well-being of Canadians, and that we would use these resources as well as the Norwegians have done, and to the satisfaction of the Norwegian economy, society, and values. So, in a word, my values are different than yours. Social values are different than yours, I think. Perhaps you can help me, show me the error of my ways, and I'll be delighted. I'm so glad you're here.
Perhaps you might be familiar with some politician with ultimate wisdom to do that. I don't. And experience has shown that when the government gets involved in business, they make a mess out of things. I've been also working bureaucracy and I know how it works. That said, yeah, the government could show some leadership, but it doesn't have to be dictated. It can be in a free market, and I mean, if we had a free market, and I'm sorry to say that because I have reason to believe otherwise, you don't dictate, you give the incentive to people to do it. But then it is like a carrot and a stick. You drive them where you want to go. Government might have good intentions, but the results don't always. Sometimes they do work, but not always. So
Enron had good intentions too. Yeah.
Yes, for themselves. Yeah.
I might have first thought and came late, but I did clip it out of the paper. I didn't hear your speech. You verged on something that I think we need to know. Do you have enough insight into the strange miasma that's invaded Edmonton in the last 13 years and Ottawa in the last few months? Is there any way at all to get through that and get the message out to make it politically feasible to do what you're talking about?
This year, most of the speakers in SACPA were trying to sell, and other politicians tried to sell us ideas. Just for a chance, the people are trying to sell an idea to the politicians today. I'm not a political person. I can't answer your question. I don't know what would be the how you implement a plan like that to make them tick. I think it's the people, the pressure, continuous pressure, and education will do the job. Hopefully.
How soon?
I don't think I'll be around to see the result. Better you, but I wouldn't.
My name is Van Christoven. Thank you so much, Gardner, for being with us today. I had the privilege of reading the paper in its rough form when it first came out and was blown away by it as to the possibilities for all of our area here in Alberta and certainly all of Canada if this sort of thing were put into effect. I am particularly excited by the broad parameters of this paper, that it covers such a wide area, not just the scientific details, not just the numeric and the calculations for costs and so on, but the an understanding of the political and the strength and the nature of the system under which we live, the capitalist system under which we live. It's included all of that, and you don't see very many papers that do that. So congratulations, Cosmo, for that. This is a preamble. Now, the question that I'd like to ask is, do you see the possibility with the need for upgrading the nuclear science part of it, the end of it, do you see a shift occurring as well? Perhaps this is a great opportunity for the development of this advanced nuclear reactor that will burn more of the energy source than is being burned today. As Cosmo said, it's only 5% of the uranium that's being used today by our nuclear reactors, and the rest is waste. Whereas it's quite possible to develop it to the point of 95% being used rather than just 5. Do you see the possibility of that research and technology being developed here in Alberta?
This technology, to a certain extent, already exists in Ontario. There's no reason why it couldn't be developed here. It will take a lot of resources and a lot of cooperation from many sectors of the society to do that. There is already some basic designs. There are some competing designs. There are actually more than one designs that they do this job. And there have been experimental tests that to prove its validity, given the resources that we have, but we could develop it here in Alberta. We're going to have our hands full with the development of the use of the nuclear products, such as hydrogen and so forth, that will absorb a lot of our manpower here. And if we were going to follow the idea that we should be helping Canada, we could buy that technology from Eastern Canada or develop it here if some people wanted. They wouldn't have much qualms to see it here done. It can be either way.
I'm Trevor Page. Thank you so much for your presentation. Very frightening presentation. Very good that you are telling us about it now. Worrisome, too, because most democratic governments can't think in more than two terms. Stay in power, or get into power, and then stay in power. And the time horizon that you paint goes beyond that. Looking at the table on how much each country has in terms of reserves, or the length of time it takes to deplete those reserves, Europe, of course, is going to run out before North America. And I wonder if you could tell us something about developments over there in terms of moving on to alternative sources of energy, particularly since my understanding is that Germany and Britain are only currently thinking about 10 to 20% of their energy being supplied by alternative sources of energy. So is the thinking over there more advanced? Are they actually moving? Because 30 to 40 years long from that, from now.
In 30 to 40 years, it is not only for the consumption part of the infrastructure, it's also for the production that we have here that they don't have in Europe. If you in France, for instance, there are 75% nuclear plants right now produce all the electricity of France versus a very small fraction that we have here in Canada. In Germany, they have the problem of the Green Party, so they just sort of tread time until things change, and they keep building plants. In the Soviet Union, they're building quite a few nuclear plants, and in Italy, they're doing that, and in Spain, quite a bit. But it takes time to sort of get up to speed on that particular energy. The industry doesn't have the capacity to build massive plants overnight. It takes time, it takes a lot of meticulous, detailed work to get those plants up and running. So they're doing some, not as much as France is doing. France has gone, it's independent energy-wise. And France, before you know, they will start pumping the hydrogen, they will have their cars in hydrogen, and they will not even blink an eye behind. And I think that was part of the strategy of going so high, so they can have enough hydrogen, and as the oils are depleted, to switch to be within an easy step to get independence energy-wise. And we're talking now in form of energy that can last us for something like 3,000 years. It's not just a small feat.
After 3,000 years,
retire. Right. Well, there are other technologies that could be coming. If you have you had the nuclear fission that we have now, was developed at the beginning of the end of the 1900s, started in 1900, and you talk us about 50 years before there was some crude prototypes, and 100 years before we had few generations to improve things up. There is the fission reactor, the fusion reactor that could come into effect, or the antimatter energy, which is another form of energy. And 3,000 years is good enough to sort of develop it.
Cosmo, as a fellow Greek, I'd like to ask you an important question. When are we going to barbecue a whole lamb?
For television, we have to have a barbecue a whole lamb.
Do you want to come repeat that question on the mic, Jim?
Now, this is a very important question for us Greeks here, Van and I and Cosmo, but I would like to ask him this important question. When are we going to barbecue a whole lamb?
And that was Jim Spoolis.
Well, it has to be next May. That gives me time over the winter to develop a nuclear barbecue.
That sounded like a good closing point, but feel free.
Yes, I suppose we should end on a note of hilarity, but I think I have a pretty serious question. Now, I was raised in a generation where we were swayed by Dr. Helen Caldicott and Amory Lovins. I think of the film If You Love This Planet, to be very concerned about the implications that reliance on nuclear energy has for our environment, for the health of people, and also for peace in the world. And I understand that there are quite a bit of risks associated with each of those things. And I know you've addressed bits and pieces of this today in the questions, but I'm just wondering if you can tell me why I, some 30 years later, should accept those risks.
That's a very good question, and I'm glad to address it a little bit, because I have a section on the paper that I've written, Facts and Fiction about Nuclear Power. If you're bringing as an example my friend Amory Lovins, I'm sorry, I don't hold my breath. He has done a good job. He has done a lot of interesting things, but he has the single, you know, it's nice to have an environmentalist that has an open mind, and if you explain the point, it is absorbed and you have a proper dialogue. But when you have a misinformed individual, fanatic to have only one way, his way, you can't have a dialogue and you can't have anything. So what you heard 30 years ago, it bothers me, but it has not been really true. They have not been true to you. And there seems to be a lot of misinformation, and I'm challenging anyone who can prove me wrong, and I can put on the table whatever it takes. In the Fact of Fiction and paper, I have addressed the cost of nuclear power. Power is unsafe, can explode like a nuclear bomb, which is a fiction. Reactors can explode like a dirty bomb, that is true, it can explode, but so can any other bomb that carries anthrax or anything like that. I mean, you have no control of it, so it can explode oil refineries the same way. Nuclear plants can produce radioactive waste that live for 100,000 years, no, it's 10,000 years, and if we put the next generation of plants, they will not be even that. They will be sand for 5 or 10 or 50 years type of thing, garbage, but nothing too serious. Nuclear material spent fuel can be stolen. Someone could make a nuclear bomb in his garage. Yes, that's true. If he has a $100 million facility in his garage, he could do it. And I'll give you just an example of that. To make a bomb, I will have to go and steal 2 truckloads of fuel. And I have to go in my garage, melt it to the point that it will gasify it or do chemical reactions to produce it, separate and enrich it. Because the fuel that we get out has only a 5% concentration of the plutonium, but we need 99.9 purity. So in order to do that, you have to do certain things. Now, and I do say somewhere in the book here, it was about in August sometime that it was in the local newspaper, it was, that some fellow in Vancouver was stopped as he was driving his car because he had triggered radiation alarms. And armed people circled his car and stopped him, and they found out after talking to him that he had some injection in his blood for diagnostic tests in the hospital. And the question I'm asking is, if that guy was stopped with a mild radiation in his blood, what will happen if I start moving two truckloads of highly radioactive plutonium? So you can sort of see Amory Lovins might talk in principles, but the devil is in the details. Go and do it. Okay? The person is a dangerous activity. It can divert fuel to bomb-grade material. Well, yeah, that is true. It could be done, and we know that Korea did it. But now the new reactors are spiking the plutonium, so you can't even do that. Even if you had two truckloads of material, you can't do that. Nuclear plants can be sabotaged by terrorists. Well, I'll tell you, my honest opinion is, knowing nuclear plants and no other industrial plants, if some terrorists were going to attack, I would prefer they attack a nuclear plant than a chlorine plant. It would make a hell of a lot more sense, because they couldn't do much with a nuclear plant except repeat a 3 Mile Island. So, yes, you heard a lot in the last 30 years. I agree to that. And I don't blame you. I blame the nuclear industry for it, for not standing up and taking a clear stand to clear the air. But that's how it is. Thank you.
Your paper, how do people access your paper?
We're going to have a website by Monday and an email. If someone emails me on Monday, I can either email back the paper or refer you to a website to get access to download it from there. My email is my last name, Cosmos Voutsinos, all in small cap, at yahoo.ca.
Sure, we have one more question.
Hi, thanks for coming today. When you gave your introduction, there was one thing that I noticed I thought was a... I thought that you were trying to make a point about how oil, the tar sands, they're limited and they're eventually going to run out, so it doesn't matter how much gasoline we use, we're eventually going to run out anyway. I think the thing is that was a bit of a fallacy, because if we encourage people to drive like four-cylinder Japanese cars instead of SUVs, and they get 5 liters for 100 kilometers instead of 15 liters for 100 kilometers or whatever, the trees have, the rate of CO2 production is slowed enough so that maybe the trees can sequester a larger percentage of it, you know what I mean, and slow the greenhouse effect. I also wanted to just ask you, like uranium and with its risks and everything, and then the tar sands and their lumps, they're going to run out. But we have tides, and we have ocean tides, we have ocean tides, we have ocean waves, we have rivers. We have wind. If we ever figure out how to harness lightning, we've got lightning. You know, like the thing is that there already exists the technology, and there's many other avenues that are totally renewable. Like we can harness the energy from it, not do any damage to the environment, and not have any risks. And I mean, maybe it's not as cost efficient right now, but it's like anything. The more you use it, the less expensive it becomes. I'm sorry, I've talked too much. I'm sorry. Sorry.
Did we get your name?
Christine Wheelock, sorry. Sorry, I'm rambling. I'll stop now.
What's your question?
Oh, yeah, how come we're not focusing on renewable things like wind, and yes, thank you.
Christine, you're right. It seems to be the attitude, should we use this or this? Should we use wind or nuclear? It's not so. Our need is so immense that we need them all to the maximum. And the more we delay, the worse it's becoming. Yes, we should use smaller cars. Yes, we should use the wind. I mean, the wind is... it's almost the same cost as on a per kilowatt basis on the paper I've given you as the nuclear. And it is cheaper, it is clean once you build. But remember, to build a windmill right now, there is a two-year waiting period because we have overstressed our capacity to manufacture and to construct things. So, yeah, and this alone, we need all forms of energy. And we shouldn't hold back anyone that is capable to produce the power that we need. But what I'm saying for the tar sands, it's a specific case where the nuclear has the higher, once you build the nuclear plant, the fuel is negligible, the cost of the fuel is meaningless. Once piece that little of nuclear fuel, when I put it into the reactor, it will power 100 houses for a year in Canada, and will have burned only 1% of it. Okay? So, go and cope with that efficiency.
Thank you very much, Cosmos. I think it's time that we brought the proceedings to a close. I'd like to thank you again, and all of our questioners. You've given us a lot of food for thought. And I think we might have set a precedent today in delivering a public talk that combines the topics of nuclear energy and Alberta tar sands. Thanks to everybody for all your support and your participation.